I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Jeff Sessions was one of candidate Trump's most ardent supporters and gave up his long-held Senate seat to serve as Attorney General. After recusing himself from overseeing the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, Sessions became President Trump's punching bag, who at one time complained, "I don't have an Attorney General." Well, Trump won't have Sessions to kick around anymore after Sessions announced that he was resigning at the request of the president. That was yesterday. His temporary replacement is Matthew Whitaker, who will oversee the Mueller investigation before a permanent attorney general is selected. Now, Democrats are calling for Whitaker to recuse himself because of the critical things that he has said about the Mueller investigation. We asked Mark Mazzetti to join us. He's Washington investigative correspondent for The New York Times, joining us by telephone. Mark Mazzetti, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
No surprise that Sessions' days were numbered. Anything significant about the firing yesterday?
Yeah, you're right. It was not surprising. You described him as the president's punching bag, and I was wondering whether that might even be an understatement. I mean, he was someone who was subjected to really ritual humiliation by the president, not only in public, but certainly in private. The day that Trump found out that Mueller had been appointed, he screamed at Sessions in private, almost moved Sessions to tears, and Sessions offered his resignation. So it was expected. I think the really significant thing was, of course, how it was handled. Not that Sessions was removed, but that they installed Matthew Whitaker, a real loyalist to Trump, someone who has criticized the Mueller investigation, as the person now overseeing the Mueller investigation. Trump could have just had Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein take over in the interim, but instead he actually put someone above Rosenstein, and that's what's caused a lot of concern.
And he was, the announcement came by tweet, correct, from the president?
Yes, as the president does a lot of his personnel announcements, it came publicly by tweet. Sessions then made public, or it was made public, his resignation letter, but it really wasn't a resignation. He said in the letter, you know, you asked me to resign and I'm resigning. So he was fired.
And there was no date on the letter. Again, any significance there?
Not that we know. It's certainly something, as you said, we've expected for some time. He had offered to resign, as I said, last year. So this was some time in coming.
Trump clearly never forgave Sessions for recusing himself from the Russia investigation and has said several times that he wants his Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn, of course, was an attorney that has a very checkered past, but nonetheless, and actually had worked with Trump when he was a businessman. Has he found his Roy Cohn in Matthew Whitaker?
Yeah, I think we'll see. The original sin of Jeff Sessions was, as you said, recusing himself from the Russia investigation. Trump never forgave him. He thought that as soon as Sessions did that, he lost control of things. So he has now put someone in who, you know, perhaps he thinks he can is more of a loyalist, is sort of the firewall that can keep things to get. From getting to directly to the president. Now, it remains to be seen whether Matthew Whitaker will serve that role. There are questions about whether Mr. Whitaker is going to have to recuse himself because there are ties he has to people who are involved in the Mueller investigation. Now, we will see whether that happens. One would think that first and foremost, President Trump would want to put someone in who would not have to recuse himself from the Russia investigation because, as we said, this was the thing that so soured President Trump on Jeff Sessions. So a lot has to play out in the next few weeks.
Whitaker said several things. He actually reposted an op-ed that was in the Philadelphia Inquirer by George Perry, who talked about the Mueller investigators as a lynch mob. He also seemed to indicate that if Sessions were fired, that the budget for the investigation could be reduced. He also had some questions about whether it was legal or not legal when some members of the Trump campaign met with Russians at Trump Tower. All these things together. Are those the reasons you think that that Trump picked Whitaker?
We don't know enough yet about why Trump picked Whitaker, but you know, as you just listed, his thoughts about the Mueller investigation are now for the public to see. He has questioned the scope of the investigation. He's questioned, some of Mueller's decisions. And so now he is in direct charge of Robert Mueller. One of the things that people have focused on is his questioning whether Mueller should be going after investigating Trump's finances, Trump's business practices, etc. It should be pointed out that right now, as best we can tell, the real locus of any kind of investigation into the Trump business practices or the Trump organization is not in Mueller's investigation. It's actually in New York. The Southern District of New York is investigating Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer. And so that is not officially part of the Mueller investigation. So these are things that need to be untangled. And what Matthew Whitaker said in public as a commentator are now might be different from what he believes or can actually do as acting attorney general.
So Rosenstein is out. He is no longer overseeing the Mueller investigation, correct?
Correct. He is still deputy. For the moment, he is still deputy attorney general. But he does not oversee Mueller because now there is someone above him who does not need to recuse himself, at least for the moment. So Mueller doesn't have Rosenstein no longer has direct control over Mueller. And that's significant because there was this view that Rosenstein, as a career prosecutor, someone who moved up through the ranks of the Justice Department, was more traditional in how he saw the Mueller investigation. He was seen as, some saw him or wanted to believe, he was an ally in the sense that he would protect Mueller. He believed in the practices of the Justice Department. Whitaker's more of a wild card.
But as I understand it, Mueller has to, as the investigation goes forward, he has to get permission from the person overseeing his investigation about things like budget or subpoenas or indictments, that person has to sign off. So that would be Whitaker's job?
Yes, that's right. And one of the things that Whitaker had indicated as a private citizen was this idea that you could sort of starve the Mueller investigation, not shut it down, but you could really, cut the budget and maybe it would die on the vine. So he does have that power to, determine the budget in this job what he said should be done when he was a private citizen. That is significant. The other thing that is quite significant is ultimately he is the arbiter of what becomes of the final Mueller report.
Right.
And he, it was the Justice Department guidelines say that special counsel Robert Mueller gives his report or whatever conclusions he has to the attorney general. The attorney general then decides what to do with it. Now, there was this view, this belief that if when Rod Rosenstein was overseeing it, he would most likely then turn over the conclusions to Congress, that he couldn't just keep it inside the Justice Department. He would, being conservative with a small C prosecutor, he would want Congress to be notified of the conclusions. Now, again, it's unclear what Whitaker would do. Would he then not choose to turn it over to Congress? Now, then it becomes interesting again because of Tuesday. No longer have the Republicans controlling two houses of Congress. We have the Democrats now in charge of the House starting in January. So now the House Judiciary Committee with Democrats in charge could try to compel the report. They could subpoena any kind of final conclusions of Mueller. They could get Mueller's investigators or Mueller himself to testify before the House Judiciary Committee. So the dynamics, because of the election this week, are quite significant. They've changed quite significantly.
And we heard Senator Coons of Delaware in our newscast saying that there needs to be some kind of protection for the special counsel. Do you think that could happen, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, there's been talk of this, of Congress legislating some kind of protection of the special counsel, even obviously before Tuesday's election. And I think there is Republican support for that. The Republicans have indicated that they do not want to see Mueller fired, that they want to see him finish his investigation. And so if there was movement in Congress, you might see bipartisan support for that.
Now, it's been Mueller was been quiet for the last a number of weeks, even 2 months leading up to the midterm election. Do you expect some announcement soon?
It's always hard to tell.
Yeah, I mean, they're very quiet, aren't they? I mean, they're very secret.
They are. I mean, we were expecting that around Labor Day, things would get quiet, at least publicly, and that's what happened, right? There were no indictments. Mueller's work continued in private, brought people before the grand jury, had private interviews, but there were no public statements, no public charges. And now that the election's over, we expect that there, that the pause is over and that we will see some action. And, it's always perilous to predict what it will be, but we've reported that there has been a lot of action around Roger Stone, President Trump's former advisor. A lot of Stone's associates have gone before the grand jury. It seems as if Mueller's team is encircling Stone, but what that might lead to, we're not sure.
I saw also that Donald Trump Jr. feels as if he is in the crosshairs or could be, subpoenaed, indicted?
Yeah, there are certainly reports of that. I mean, in a federal investigation like this, it's sometimes as illuminating to find out who hasn't been called before the grand jury or who hasn't been interviewed, interesting as a sign of who has. So best we can tell, neither Roger Stone nor Donald Trump Jr. has been called in to be interviewed by Mueller. That usually means it's not good for those people. It usually means that maybe there's a case being built against them. I don't want to say that there is, but the fact that Donald Trump Jr. Does not appear to have been called in as a witness in this is not a good sign for him.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, are there names already being floated for Attorney General for the permanent job?
There were names that were floated before the election. Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, his name has been floated. Others have been floated. This really caught people, I think, by surprise. Again, not that Sessions was going to get fired, but just the installation of Whitaker. Now, Whitaker now has, I think, it's 210 days he can serve as acting until Trump has to nominate someone new. So we have some time where Whitaker could serve as the acting attorney general before a permanent replacement needs to be found.
And I'm just doing the math very quickly here. That takes us well into 2019, correct?
Yes, that's right. So Whitaker really could have a very significant role in the future of the Mueller investigation.
We're going to leave it there. Mark Mazzetti, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Okay, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Getting us up to speed on the firing yesterday of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and he is Washington investigative correspondent for the New York Times. Well, shifting gears as we always do, we'll be talking with astronaut Scott Kelly after this very short break. Do stay with us. Much, much to talk about. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoena, and this is Radio Times.
Now, last month, we launched a new spacecraft as part of a re-energized space program that will send American astronauts to Mars. And in 2 months, to prepare us for those missions, Scott Kelly will begin a year-long stay in space. So good luck, Captain. Make sure to Instagram it. We're proud of you.
That was President Obama at the 2015 State of the Union address wishing NASA astronaut Scott Kelly bon voyage before Kelly was about to spend 340 days on the International Space Station and set the record for the longest time in space by an American. His almost year on the station helped to advance science, our understanding about the physical and psychological effects of deep space exploration, and what it could take to send a person to Mars. Kelly wrote a memoir last year, Endurance, about how he went from being an indifferent and distracted student to a Navy test pilot and astronaut with four space missions under his belt. His new book, Infinite Wonder, is a collection of extraordinary photographs he took from space, detailing life inside the space station, the views of the Milky Way, and breathtaking images of planet Earth that look like abstract art. We have posted some of those photographs on our homepage. Scott Kelly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty. Thank you.
I should say, when you found out you were going to be with us for almost an hour, you said, can't we talk about something else? What should we talk about?
Well, I talk about space all the time.
I know,
I guess,
but we don't. We don't get to do that.
And I guess considering the last subject you were talking about, this is much more lighter and
Well, we're happy to
friendly.
Have you because I don't get to talk to people like you very often. So it's a pleasure to have you here. I'm curious, you've been back on Earth, obviously, a couple of years since that last trip to the space station. Are there any residual effects, physical effects that you've had of spending that much time in space?
Well, nothing that I can feel, no symptoms. I did, upon returning after being in space for a long time, have some symptoms that were surprising to me, having flown 6 months previously. But those, you know, for the most part, you know, dissipated over time. And I would say after about 8 months being back on Earth, I felt completely back to normal. Now, that doesn't mean physiologically everything is returned to normal. I do have some structural effects of my eyes.
Some vision issues?
It doesn't affect my visual acuity, but when astronauts spend a long time in space, they do get structural changes that in some cases never return back to normal. And then, of course, there's the effects on my DNA that was reported in the paper or in the media, how my gene expression had changed. So like 7% of my genes are no longer expressing like they did before the flight.
That's wild.
Yeah, right?
What does that
I don't know.
Mean? Do you know?
I have no idea.
Oh, interesting.
Well, it depends. So gene expression is your DNA, RNA, or proteins turning on or off.
Right.
And it just depends on what those genes control, and we don't know that. So it might be a good thing, or it might not be a good thing.
And you can live with that. I guess you have to.
I either will or I won't.
Well, what makes you interesting is that you have a brother, twin brother, Mark Kelly, who's also an astronaut. Mm-hmm. So part of that mission to the space station was to be able to compare and contrast the two of you just to see how the impact of living in space that long has on a human being.
Yeah, so my brother, also an astronaut, flew in space four times and we're identical twins, so, you know, genetically we're almost exactly the same, or at least we were almost exactly the same.
Until you went out there, right?
Yeah, so for, you know, a space flight like this, first American spending that long in space and also having an identical twin brother, it was an opportunity for NASA to enter into the realm of genetic-based research. We had never done that before in space. And this was a good way to get started in that. And it was, you know, they had found some interesting results, like
the
my
DNA.
Gene expression. Yeah.
Interesting. Does being in space that long, does it change a person psychologically? Are you a different person because of that?
You know, I think I wouldn't say you're a different person, but I think you do have a different perspective on the planet for a couple of reasons. Maybe there's a few. So when you look at the Earth from space and you get to see the atmosphere, and the first time I looked out and I saw this film over the surface, I was like, what is that? And then you realize, you know, that's our atmosphere.
Yeah.
And it looks like, you know, when you look up in the sky, it seems like the sky is infinitely large. When you look down from space, our atmosphere looks like a thin film over the surface. And you think about, you know, how fragile it is. The planet itself is very beautiful, yet there are spots that are almost always covered with pollution.
Yeah.
You see weird weather systems in different places. So there's, you know, there's the environmental, you know, you get a newfound sense for protecting the planet. And then there's also the idea that when you look out at the Earth and you don't see any political borders, you see continents, you know, you get a sense for we are all on this planet together, and to solve anything, we need to do it together. There's a lot of issues that, you know, require attention that can only be solved with teamwork. And, you know, at NASA, spaceflight, biggest team sport ever. So when you consider, like, all the news coming from this beautiful planet, and I think it gives you a new sense of empathy for humanity.
Did being an astronaut turn you into a photographer?
Yeah, it did. Not by choice. It's part of the job. I was when I became an astronaut, it was before the time when everyone had the camera in their
on the
pocket.
Phone. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So I would take pictures like, you know, people would on vacation. It was not a hobby of mine. But when you become an astronaut, photography is a big part of the job, not just to take pictures to make a book someday, but for scientific reasons, whether it's a scientific experiment studying the atmosphere or you're collecting data on science inside the space station. We take a lot of photos for engineering purposes. A piece of hardware breaks. You need to get a close-up photo. How do you do that well so engineers can use it? You take it for public relations, to document, historically document what we're doing. And then you take them for your own, you know, your own purposes, whatever those may be. And in my case, a third of my book are these artistic images.
And they're beautiful. I mean, it's almost unrecognizable that this this is a desert. This is a mountain range. Yeah. This is snow. This is, you know, it looks like abstract art.
Yeah. And it's hard to get those photos because I was using a really long lens, so a close-up image of the Earth, and then taking it while traveling at 5 miles a second.
Which is what, 17,000?
17,500 miles an hour.
An hour.
So you have to not only move the camera in one direction to keep it pointed at the Earth with as little extra motion or lateral motion or whatever vibration as required to get a picture in focus, but also at the same time be tracking that spot very, very quickly. So it takes months and months to develop this kind of a technique to get those pictures.
Yeah. Steady hands, I'm assuming.
Yeah, very, very – not only steady hands but steady body because you're floating and just to control your motion in space takes, you know, months and months to get adapted to that environment.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Scott Kelly, astronaut, spent almost a year on the International Space Station, has a book of really, as I say, beautiful photographs called Infinite Wonder, an astronaut's photographs from a year in space. Also wrote a memoir, and it's actually, I have the Young Readers edition here. It's called Endurance, about his life and how he got into this line of work. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I really appreciate the fact that you write about being lousy, perhaps is the right word. I'll say indifferent student, that you were not a good student, not particularly interested in school. As you said, if they had ADD or ADHD back then, they probably would have applied it to yourself. Well, yeah. But you were, if you hadn't read Tom Wolfe's book, what would you have been, do you think?
You know, I don't know. I always had the best intentions. You know, every year I would, start the school year thinking, I'm going to do better. And, 3 days in, I was 3 days behind on homework. And
didn't do your homework?
I couldn't. It was impossible. I felt like it was impossible for me to pay attention. So I can really relate to kids that feel the same way. I wanted to do better, but I just couldn't. And it wasn't until I got to college. I was still struggling. I just walking across the school campus one day and just walk into the college bookstore, not to buy a book.
Right.
I wasn't.
Because you didn't do books, right?
Yeah, I wasn't a big reader at the time, and walked in there to buy like gum or something, and saw this book on the shelf, and it just looked really cool cover. So I picked it up. I looked at the back, read the back.
Changed your life, right?
Took my gum money, bought the book, went back to my dorm room and laid there for the next 3 days and just read these incredible stories about real people, which, I felt like I could relate to these guys. They were all guys at the time, but I felt like I could relate to them with one big exception. And then I didn't know how to learn or study, but I thought, you know, it might be hard for me to fix that problem, but if I could, maybe I could go and fly in the Navy someday or the Air Force. I wanted to be in the Navy, which was good. A little bit more challenging flying, landing on the ship, I found out. And maybe even a test pilot, maybe quite possibly an astronaut someday.
And that was from opening this book and reading about these
absolutely
so, early astronauts.
Yeah, so if I didn't read that book, what would I be
yeah,
doing?
Yeah, what would you have done?
I have no idea.
Wow. You worked for EMT for a while.
As a volunteer, as a young kid in my hometown of West Orange, New Jersey. My brother and I volunteered as EMTs on the volunteer ambulance. I later did it in a paid capacity when I was really young. Somehow my brother and I were able to get this job. I think my dad had twisted some arms or something, maybe. But we were, I did that. Had some wild idea that maybe I could be a physician, even though I couldn't do my homework. But I think a lot of times kids have wild ideas about doing things. Sometimes they turn out, though, like in my case.
Apparently
right?
They do, and yeah. That's always good to know. But you also write about you and your brother kind of roaming the neighborhood, getting in trouble. Your brother, Mark, your brother having all sorts of injuries.
He had some really bad luck, when we were kids. It was always him, like, breaking his arm or getting shot in the foot by a BB gun and actually almost losing his foot, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah.
You even describe being, you say toddler, so I'm assuming a couple of years old, kind of roaming the neighborhood by yourself.
Yeah, our parents gave us a really long leash and, perhaps maybe that was good for us, gave us a sense of independence and risk-taking and but I wouldn't have raised my kids like my parents raised my brother and I.
Kind of out in the wild, right?
Yeah, but it was a different time, too. Yeah.
There's a photo in your book looking down. I think it's on Hurricane Patricia, but you say that your mother was rather like Hurricane Patricia, kind of a force of nature.
Yeah, she was a great person. When my brother and I were teenagers, she decided that she wanted to become a police officer like my dad. Prior to that, she was a secretary and a waitress and had various jobs. But when we were getting a little older, she thought, maybe a career, not a normal career like you might expect for a woman at that time, but becoming a police officer was something she was interested in. And there were no female police officers in my hometown. There were none in very few in the state. West Orange, New Jersey.
Right.
Yeah. And she had to do all the same tests, the physical fitness tests and things that were designed for the men. And she had trouble at first, but she worked really, really hard at it for months and months and eventually was able to, overcome those challenges and did really, really well and was a cop for many years. She's like one of those cops that if you're going to get pulled over for like speeding, you'd want to get pulled over by her.
she'd be very nice.
She'd be just like, "Hey, please don't do that again." And
you also say your dad was an alcoholic.
he was for most of his mm-hmm. life, and that's a challenge growing up in that kind of environment. In some ways, you look at how you were raised and things that made an impression on you, and I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I think it taught my brother and I how to deal with very challenging situations, adversity, and hopefully made us stronger people as a result. But it's not an easy thing to deal with.
Not at all. You mentioned reading the right stuff. And when you were on the space station, you wrote to Tom Wolf and you said, "Please let me introduce myself. My name is Scott Kelly. I'm currently the commander of the International Space Station. I just wanted to take this opportunity while I'm still in space to send you a note of thanks and this picture of your book cover with me. When I was 18 years old, I was directionless and a very poor student. I read your book and it changed my life." And I would think any writer getting a letter like that, especially from the space station, would feel pretty good about what they wrote.
Yeah, and it was great to get Tom's response to that because in his very unique writing style of, in some cases like made up word that he just threw in there and some outrageous punctuation, it was a real pleasant surprise to get a response. Yeah,
you mentioned the fact that you were a Navy pilot, fighter pilot, mm-hmm. Part of a squadron called the world famous Puking Dogs.
Yeah, that's their name.
What was that about?
Oh,
besides, I think
is,
what we know it's about.
This is just the United States Navy at in the 1980s. But that was a name. They used to be called the Griffins, which is some mythological winged dog-looking thing. And I think it was during the Vietnam War. Someone said, "What's a griffin? That looks like a puking dog." So that was their name.
That was the name.
Official name, by the way.
Interesting. And there's some photographs in there. Yeah. But you also describe how hard – I mean, I can only imagine how hard it is to land on an aircraft carrier.
It is the hardest piloting task there is, in my opinion. It's gotten easier over time. The airplanes have gotten a little bit more automated, sophisticated. The landing aids are better. But for the when I was flying, it was more challenging, especially in the F-14 Tomcat, which was notorious for just being very difficult to land at very poor flying qualities in the landing configuration. And it was harder than landing the space shuttle, actually.
Well, in fact, you describe it. It feels like you just don't know what's underneath you. I mean, you can't see anything.
It's almost like being on a motorcycle and, it being dark and you getting up to, 100 miles an hour and, like, driving right through a doorway and, hoping everything works out well. Especially when there's no moon, when it's dark, the weather's bad. I would say about half the time it was terrifying.
Just
at night. At night.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And is it you just eventually learn sort of by sound, by some kind of weird orientation that you knew where you were so you knew how to do it?
I think you just learn to deal with being terrified after that.
Those are good skills to have, though, right?
Like anything else, the more you practice, the better you get at it. I never quite got comfortable landing at night. In the F-14. I enjoyed it during the daytime, but at night was a completely different story.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation again. Scott Kelly is our guest and retired as a NASA astronaut, spent a number of years, of course, working as an astronaut. And he flew 4 space flights, commanded the International Space Station and spent almost a year on the space station. And again, he's got a book for kids called Endurance. And he's also got a collection of photographs. We posted some of them on our homepage called Infinite Wonder. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Scott Kelly, former military fighter pilot, engineer, and retired U.S. Navy captain and astronaut as well. You've had 4 missions into space. What was the biggest difference between the first and the fourth?
Oh, the biggest, a lot of differences. My first flight was it was my first flight, so it's brand new. Anytime something's new, it's you don't know what to expect exactly. But it was on the space shuttle. I was the pilot of Space Shuttle Discovery to the Hubble Space Telescope. So it could be it was probably about as different as a space flight could possibly be between like my first and my last. So,
right.
My last flight, I was launching on a Russian Soyuz to the space station. I was going to spend a year there. I was the commander. There's no pilot of the space station. It doesn't really need piloting, but you do need somebody in charge. So I was the commander of the crew. I did 3 spacewalks. I was 17 years older, had a lot more experience. I had previously, flown 3 times. So absolutely, completely different. And the difference between a short flight on the space shuttle that we used to fly and a long flight when you're living in space is like the difference between baseball and football. They're both sports, but that's really all they have in common. Everything else is different.
You have a photograph here of the Soyuz being dragged to the launch pad by a train only 2 days prior to flight. And in the front of the photograph is just trash lying around. And I have to say, looking at that, I thought, gosh, I don't know how much that inspires confidence that you're going to be in good shape taking off.
Yeah, the Russians do a lot with a little. And their spacecraft, the Soyuz, has been flying for a long time. Very robust. We had a mishap here recently, but it's has great emergency escape system, as was very well demonstrated. And they've been flying it a long time. So, on one hand, when you see, trash lying around, you're rocky.
A little nervous. But
the fact that they can – pull that thing out on a train 2 days before launch and launch it into space is pretty impressive.
So interesting to have, you know, Russian partners. You write about that your compatriots essentially as you're going up to the space station, and obviously time there as well. And all the conflicts on Earth seem to disappear.
Yeah. So you're aware of the stuff going on the planet. Definitely aware of conflicts between, you know, as an example, the United States and Russia. When I was on the space station this last time was when the Russian military moved into Syria. So there was concern that maybe unintentionally we could get into some kind of, armed conflict with another between our two countries. And we would talk about that a little bit, but it was almost like talking about it in a very abstract way, like you were talking about two other countries. Yeah. Because when we're on board the space station, you know, we're crewmates, we're friends, we rely on each other for many things, you know, support with our work, support emotionally, psychologically, and even in some cases we rely on each other for literally our lives if
sure.
it depended on it.
Sure. Let me read some comments. A tweet from Drew. Is it true that when in space with your eyes closed, you can see flashes of radiation?
Yeah, you can see cosmic radiation hitting your retina when your eyes are closed, and you know, I wouldn't necessarily say dark adapted, and it depends on a number of things. But one is your altitude. On a Hubble mission that is almost twice as high as the space station, you could see those cosmic ray flashes
wow.
much more frequently than on the space station. But you know, it's one of the many things that makes it challenging to sleep in space when you consider that cosmic ray not only hit my retina, but also passed completely through my brain.
Goodness. Well, speaking of sleeping in space, I want to play you're on this space station, International Space Station, and describing what it's like to sleep up there.
Sleeping is done on the wall here in a sleeping bag. It's a very comfortable way to sleep once you get used to it. At first it's can be rather difficult, but once you get the hang of it, it's actually really comfortable, more comfortable than on Earth for me at least. I sleep much better up here than I do in my own bed at home. And so even though you're floating, I guess because it takes a lot of the pressure off your body, it's actually rather comfortable.
So you sleep better in space?
I don't know if I really agree with that.
With your own self, right?
Yeah, I was listening to that, and I was like, huh, did I really say that?
Probably,
you know, because
when
I got home, the bed felt so great. And the sheets, you know, and the pillow, you don't have any of that. So I don't know. I might have to take that back.
All right. Well, it's up to you. Here's an email from Carrie. Scott, I read your book, Endurance. Did you taste the $1 million espresso? If so, was it any good? And there's a photograph in here of that espresso machine.
You know, I think it was a $100,000 espresso because we had 10 of them, and I think the whole thing cost like $1 million.
Wow.
It was not U.S. taxpayer dollars. This was ESA, European Space Agency money. You know, good coffee is really important to Europeans, so they flew this really sophisticated espresso machine, and we had 10 little coffee bags. So I had a $100,000 cup of coffee in space. That was
how did it taste?
It tasted pretty good, almost like this place I got. I'm not going to say the name because I don't know if you're allowed to do that. But
down the street from us,
the place down the street, which has some fantastic coffee, it was kind of like this.
What did you miss? I mean, there must have been so many things that you missed, including you. In fact, you describe when you would get a delivery of food of fresh, fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, fruits and vegetables. Yeah, you don't have much of that because we only get a resupply every few months, and as we know, you know, fruits and vegetables don't really last that long, or they don't seem to last that long in space anyway.
Right.
For some reason, stuff seems to spoil faster. The tomatoes and other things that they would send. You wonder if that's what's happening to your cells as well in space. But, yeah, you miss fresh food. You miss – what I miss the most was people. You know, your loved ones, your family, your friends, you know, people that you spend your life with that you are now separated from for a really long time. Even though you still like – you know, great crewmates. They're all fantastic. I enjoyed the time I spent with them. But – you know, you do miss the people. And then, of course, you know, the earth. You miss earth.
Sure.
You miss going
sure.
outside. You miss the sun, the rain, the wind, nature, animals. I remember I got back and been back for a week, and I was walking outside my house, and this dog runs up to me, and it might as well have looked like some kind of alien creature attacking me.
In fact, you described coming back from the space station, and just when the door opened, you were in Russia, the door opened, and just what the outside world smelled like, what the grass smelled like.
Yeah, when you're in this very tightly controlled environment that you cannot leave, even though the space station is pretty big, still it's a space you can never get away from. When you come back to Earth and the hatch opens and all of a sudden you have fresh air, which, you know, the air on the space station keeps us alive, but it's not always the greatest.
No, I can only imagine.
And when that fresh air rushed inside for the first time and you get the smell of the burnt grass in the landing area that the capsule interacts with, and the smell of the heat shield, which is that charred smell, it almost has this like sweet fragrance. And then when they pull you out of the capsule, there's like 100 people there. You know, it's like just overwhelming to see all these people when you haven't seen a lot of people in a really long time.
Yeah. Comment from Joe, who's a retired Navy captain. I relate to being a poor student, but still accomplishing things after graduation. Some psychiatrists/psychologists say that being a poor student can be the result of being under-challenged and bored.
I was definitely bored. I don't know if I was under-challenged because I got bad grades. it was all seemed really challenging. It was just challenging to pay attention.
Yeah.
But for me, it was a matter of not having this inspiration. Like, I didn't feel like I needed to do well because there was not this really other thing I felt so strongly about that I wanted to be a part of. Once I figured that out, eventually it got easier.
Yeah. You describe, obviously you walked in space, mm-hmm. How, I guess, exhausting that is.
Yeah, spacewalking is, and when we say walking, I don't know why we say walking, there's no walking involved, but you're crawling on the outside of the space station. It's really a lot of work involved, but it's type two kind of fun. So type one fun is the roller coaster. When you're right. doing it, you're like, wow, this is fun. Type two fun is the thing that's fun when it's done, when it's like over.
Yes.
And you're like, wow, I'm glad that's over. Then like a week later, you go, you know what? That was pretty fun. But at the time, it's exciting, it's challenging, it's very, very mentally exhausting, physically exhausting, interesting, mm-hmm. but not exactly fun while you're doing it.
Yeah. You even described getting headaches because of what, CO2 problems?
Yeah, the space station, when the carbon dioxide is at its lowest,
yeah.
is 10 times higher than what it is on Earth. And if it gets any higher than that, which it sometimes does, it can cause all kinds of symptoms that are not very comfortable.
Did other astronauts have that as well? I mean,
it's
just a condition of being.
Yeah, a lot of people do. I think I'm particularly sensitive to it, though, so that's why I wrote a lot about it in my book.
Yeah. Let me get Joe from Deptford to join us on Radio Times. And Joe, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I don't remember if I heard or read that a prolonged time in space leads to a loss of bone density. And my question to your guest is, how does NASA plan to address that in terms of long-term space travel, for example, a mission to Mars?
Sure.
Well, you're absolutely right. It does. About 1% a month. If you didn't do anything to prevent it, after 100 months, you would have like no skeleton left. Our bodies are really smart. They realize when you get to space, hey, I don't need this skeleton anymore to support my organs and the rest of me. So I'm just going to get rid of it, and you get rid of the calcium in your bones through your urine. But we do things to prevent that, and we do a lot of exercise. And the exercise equipment is great. One of the best pieces of hardware on the space station is this resistive exercise device, this weightlifting machine that uses evacuated cylinders to provide resistance. And if you do that per the instructions and your, the plan, if you exercise, you know, 6 or 7 days a week, you don't lose much bone mass. You lose a little bit. Unfortunately, sometimes you lose it in not the greatest places. We've had two astronauts break their hips after returning.
Because of their weakened bones, I guess?
Possibly. I mean, that you know, when you get have relatively young guys breaking their hips, you wonder, right, you know, if that's if they're related. So it's definitely a concern, but it's one, I think, one of the many challenges I think we understand very well and will be able to mitigate for, you know, future missions to Mars.
And you see that in our future? I mean, some probably distant future?
Someday. I hope I get to see people on Mars in my lifetime. I think we it's inevitable. We are explorers. We will go there someday.
Will we come back?
Well, I'll tell you what. If I was going, I would want to come back. I would not want to live the rest of my life in some enclosed habitat. I know there are people that are willing to do that. I'm not one of them. I'd definitely be willing to watch that reality show about the one-way mission to Mars. But you know, I'll quote something my brother often says, and that is, going to Mars is not about rocket science. It's really about political science. It's really the politics and the funding that is the long pole in the tent, so to speak, to getting to Mars.
Well, there's a lot of privatizing of mm-hmm. space exploration. Is that, do you feel like that is a good use of private dollars, or does it take away from the kind of mission that NASA's had?
Well, I think it's great. I think there is a place for, you know, private money, or, you know, as well as a place for a government-funded space program. And they're, you know, they're related in some way. Like, you know, SpaceX has had a lot of success, great company. They've been able to build a system to resupply the space station with NASA funds. I mean, NASA has funded part of that, a large part of it, actually. So I think there's a place – there's a lot of space out there. So there's a lot of space for everybody, and it's great to have guys like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk are willing to devote their time and in some cases their own money to making space more accessible to the people of Earth.
Was it hard to, I guess, end your time as an astronaut? Or did you feel like you were ready?
You know, yeah, I've had a very privileged career at NASA, having flown in space four times, twice on the space shuttle, as the commander of the space shuttle once, the commander of the space station, three spacewalks. I didn't really – spending a year in space, which was a long time for NASA astronauts to do that. So I didn't feel like I had any other mission that would have been different, much different than what I had done so far. And there are a lot of very qualified people at NASA that should be flying in space the first time before I fly the fifth time. So it made sense for me to leave when I did.
There's a photograph of a space gorilla. How was that taken up into space?
I don't know anything about that.
How do you sneak a gorilla suit up into space?
When you have a brother that's a former astronaut, I guess they can figure stuff out. But that was actually the second gorilla suit in space. The
really?
first one blew up on a SpaceX rocket, and then my brother got back on Amazon and got another gorilla suit.
That's great.
And you can Google space gorilla and see him flying around inside the space station.
Well, Scott Kelly, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty.
A great
Thank
pleasure.
You.
And again, he's got a book for young readers called Endurance, My Year in Space and How I Got There, and also a collection of photographs, Infinite Wonder, and Astronauts Photographs from a Year in Space, of course, on the International Space Station. And again, we have posted some of those photographs on our homepage. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.